Welcome to Language as Purpose. I'm Eureka Foster. Hosta Eureka desu. And I've found purpose in learning and using the Japanese language. And here I'm speaking with other people who have a passion for text or they use their language skills and help people engage with the wider world. So hear how my guests are helping us be more open to what we don't know and how language can highlight our human qualities in this technology-reliant world. Today, I'm speaking with a translator and translation journal editor who is also a professor emeritus at York University in Toronto, Ted Goossen. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Hi. So just to start off with, it would be great for the audience to hear why you chose the Japanese language to work within. If there's a specific reason, like a mission per se, you know, or did you read a Japanese author that impacted you and that kind of started you on your path? Could you give us a little introduction into how you got started?
Yeah. So I was born in 1948, which was a long time ago. And so my university years coincided with the protests against the war in Vietnam, which occurred both in the United States and in Japan. And I went to Japan almost by accident. I was sitting in the in the student cafeteria, and I hope
and
your readers won't be shocked, but it is in Oberlin, Ohio.
Okay.
But I was really stoned, and I was generally stoned at that time in my life. I was 19 okay. years old. I was on a small town in Ohio, mainly to play basketball, and I didn't enjoy either. So somebody nudged me as I was sitting there, bleary-eyed, and said, "You know, they're doing interviews for a year abroad in Japan next door in the next building." And I had never heard of this or had no idea that such a thing was taking place. So I kind of ambled over to that place, and the people were just locking up the door where they'd finished their interviews.
That's very
and
lucky.
And they looked at me and they said, "Okay, we can do one more." So they unlocked the door and let me in. So if I'd been there 10 seconds later, I wouldn't have gone. And they interviewed me, and I think I was very relaxed.
Naturally.
Given my condition. And it turned out they were looking for survivors. We're talking about 1968, and there were very few foreigners in Japan at that time. And the last 2 years, they had lost two students, one to an accident and the other to a mental breakdown.
And
so they were, and it's a small program, about 20 people per year on this program. So they were very, very traumatized by this. And really looking for people who they thought would survive the immersion and isolation.
So they said, "This one will survive."
That's right. That's right. And I looked so loose because I was so stoned. And then they interviewed me, and it went well. And even though my grades were poor, they accepted me into the program.
Did they even ask you why you're interested? Or
yeah, so I mean, I had an interest in a lot of things. You know,
but more to kind of get out and see.
Yeah,
I know
there were no Japanese language classes on my campus. There weren't, generally speaking, in 1968, there were only a very few in the United States. So I knew nothing. So I went there, and it was organized by the Great Lakes Colleges Association, which was centered at Erland College in Indiana. It was a good program. And they sent us all, we arrived, they gave us 10 days of intensive Japanese, and then they sent us all to live with farm families in various parts of Japan, isolating us and forcing us to be immersed.
But where did they have you immersed for the first 10 days? Was that in a school?
Actually, there was one brief thing at Erland before we got on the plane. And then after we got off the plane, another 10 days at a ski resort. It was summer, so nobody was skiing. So I'm sure they got a good deal on the ski resort.
Do you remember but during those initial days, I mean, you know, tasting the food or kind of the initial mannerisms or nature of folks you were talking with, did you immediately feel not at home, but I mean, comfortable? Or did you feel like, okay, this is going to be a very, very different experience?
Well, both. I felt quite comfortable. I grew up always as an outsider. So I was an outsider as a small child because we lived in a farm district. So all my fellows, students were farm boys.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved from there to New York City, where I went to a school where most of the, almost all the students were Jewish.
Okay.
And I was a scholarship student there. And again, I made lots of good friends, but I was always an outsider. I played basketball. I lived on the Upper West Side. So the games that I played in, I often integrated the games because they were mostly black players that I was playing with.
Which school was this, may I ask?
Always an outsider. Uh-huh. And in that sense, I felt strangely at home being that and challenged. It was a very challenging thing because I only had literally less than 3 weeks of intensive language training, and you don't pick up much that way. So I kept getting words mixed up, like kire means pretty. And kidai means I don't like it. And I kept getting those two words mixed up, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that can happen in any language at the beginning, right? And it's just so frustrating sometimes. And you think to yourself, no, I know. I heard.
And there were no English speakers in that town. It was in outside of a small city called Toyohashi. And there were no foreigners in Toyohashi either. So, when I went out in the fields to work with my farm mother, we were harvesting watermelons. People would gather. I mean, this was way out in the sticks, but people would gather. The first day, there were like half a dozen people. And the second day, there were dozens of people. And the third day, it was like a solid line of people just wanting to see me, physically see me, a foreigner. There, harvesting watermelons.
But at least, I guess, if you had experienced farm life earlier in life, I mean, that's at least something that you had. That was the
That's right.
A staple that you could depend on. You that
they were wonderful. They were wonderful people, and even though we had no language, we were able to get along. And it was very rustic. The ofuro was a goemonburo. It's like,
and for our audience who does not know what ofuro means.
Yeah, so it's a bath. It was made like you took a bath in a barrel, and you heated it with fire, literal fire underneath. So the obasan, the grandmother in the family, would stoke the fire as I sat there.
I wish I could be there right now.
It was very, very fun.
That sounds amazing.
I'm 6'5", and the family, the tallest in the family, was my farm mother, who was 5 feet tall, and the father was a little bit shorter, and then there were grandmother was even shorter, and then there were two little kids. So, when I walked into a room and I looked around to make sure I wasn't going to hit my head on something would hit me in the neck. that kind of environment. But seriously, though, I got used to being immersed. And I think of all the things that people should know who want to learn Japanese is that the best way, and maybe the only way, is to be completely immersed in it for a while.
Sure.
And so that you have to use the language. You don't have recourse to speak English. There are no English speakers around.
Mm-hmm.
It's stressful. You go to sleep exhausted from communicating, and then you have dreams about.
Well, yeah, and there is a stress when you are still learning the right words to use. There's mental stress with it that comes. But can I just ask you? Can I just take you back for a second to New York City? What was the school that you transferred to in New York City?
So I was a scholarship student in a school called Birchwaffen, which was one of a number of small private schools. The area where I lived in was a very rough area. And so I couldn't go to the public school because there was no education taking place there. And it was rough. It was, So now I live in Toronto, and one of the great things about Toronto is everybody goes to public school. But it wasn't like that in New York.
Did you have a hard time? Like you said, there is already a comfort level because you kind of had this sort of outsiderness about you in every situation. But was going to New York City in some ways more stressful than Japan, or was Japan a lot more?
Yeah, I don't get stressed that easily. So I think that there's a real difference between people. People get stressed quite easily. And, mm-hmm. I have this nonki in Japanese, yours are nonki, but kind mm-hmm. of a stupid laid back quality about me. So I can kind of navigate. And I enjoy the challenge. I enjoy getting to know people. I love hearing people's stories. And that's partly why I'm in literature.
Well, so that's interesting because I think outside of literature, people might think of translators as, I don't want to say rigid, but kind of by the book, because maybe they imagine them, you know, with dictionaries or on their computers all the time. And they're just very, you know, keyed into what they're doing. You're saying your personality is a bit more loose. Plus, you love meeting people and, you know, learning new things. Do you recall if what excited you at the beginning in Japan is kind of similar to what still excites you about working in it today? Or is it a completely different realm now since you're so many years?
No, 1968. Yeah, 1968 mm-hmm. is what, 56 years ago? So I've been going back and forth to Japan all that time. So in a way, Japan is a home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
New York is a home.
Mm-hmm.
But my real home, my kind of where I hang my hat, is Toronto. But when the plane approaches Narita and I look down, I feel a sense of comfort. You know, I'm coming back to a place that I know and that I miss. You know, I miss my friends.
Yeah.
I miss living in Japanese. I don't have a chance to speak Japanese in my daily life here.
Okay.
So it's a pleasure to go back and use it and see my friends. So it's not stressful.
Yeah.
What is stressful is when I have to appear and make public speeches and so forth in Japanese. That's hard.
Oh, no,
and
of course.
I'm not good at it and I don't like it. You know, when I see myself on TV, I cringe.
You mean you cringe both in English and Japanese or more in
only Japanese?
In Japanese. Only in Japanese.
No, yeah. I don't feel stressed out now. If we were doing this in Japanese, I probably would.
Do you, would you say that there's anything specific or extra outside of the work that you do in Japanese to sort of practice or that you have done in the past to practice your ease of working in the language? I think some people think that Japanese culture and Japanese can be emotive in different ways. And so I've heard of people doing Japanese calligraphy or practicing haiku or ikebana, like trying to put themselves into the culture in a way to make things, I guess, kind of a way of immersing themselves in the culture, not just the language. I mean, have you done anything in the past to kind of help you?
Well, you know, the first time I went, again, going back to when I was 20, but mm-hmm. I played basketball with the Waseda University team.
Nice.
That taught me a huge amount to be a member of a team like that, mm-hmm. even though I couldn't communicate very well yet. Just watching the dynamics on the team,
sure.
and making friends with players on the team. And then I was immersed in that. And then the next time I went to Japan, my wife and I strangely ended up as the kind of the live-in house parents of a group of about 20 women who were living in a rooming house in what had been a sake factory. So I was including my wife, over 20 women and no other guys around. And that was pretty funny. But it was also, I was immersed invisibly because I was answering the phones for them all. There was only one phone in the whole building, answering phones for them all and making sure that they were okay when they came back late and blah, blah, blah. So I was a house mother in a way.
But this is not a working sake distillery. This was a former...
No, it had been a sake. It's in Fushimi, which in Kyoto is one of the central sake making areas.
That must have been beautiful.
So there were four corners on that intersection. Three were sake factories and ours was a converted sake factory.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did you have a lot of visitors then?
So no,
There were no tours going.
Because we were replacing the house parents of the building. The father had had a stroke and had to be close to where he worked. Mm-hmm. So that's why they let us come in. My wife was really smart. I was in Taiwan studying Chinese, and she interviewed for this apartment by herself. And she showed them a photograph of me when I was 8. And I was very cute. You know, I wasn't a sketchy looking 20-year-old university, or at that point, 25-year-old university student. And then she wrote, she has beautiful kanji, beautiful calligraphy. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So she wrote things for the woman who interviewed her. And the woman was so impressed with her writing that even though she didn't speak much Japanese, mm-hmm. She gave us that apartment to live in.
And there you go.
It was cool.
Also, yeah. Actually, two questions then. Is your wife also a translator? And why did you stop studying Chinese? What was the...
Yeah, so the idea was, you know, we met in Hong Kong when I was 20. And then she came to Canada, which is one of the reasons I emigrated to Canada. And then she learned Japanese, studied Japanese at the University of Toronto. And her Japanese is very good. Our kids speak Japanese, too. So we have a bilingual family in that sense. And the idea was that I would go to Taiwan and I would catch up with her Chinese.
And that she would come because it's just that easy.
Exactly. You know, yeah, so easy. Dream on. And then she would come to Japan and catch up with my Japanese, which she more or less did. And have a relationship which includes some Chinese. The problem is I studied Mandarin and her family speaks Cantonese.
There's a difference there, yeah.
That has been an impediment.
Okay.
But it's useful to know Chinese or to be with someone who is Chinese so that you don't see everything in binary terms. Like things tend to devolve into the U.S. and Japan. And people say, well, you know, it's an either or for them.
Yeah.
And that's not good mentally, intellectually, right?
Agreed.
So by having a partner who's Chinese, it kind of triangulates things. So you don't see uniquely Japanese because it's not like what we do in the United States. That kind of mentality.
I would also think it might help the way you learn Japanese if in essence you're learning it at the same time, or you can discuss what might be challenging about learning it and you can help each other move through that process.
Completely. Yeah.
Okay. I did look up, you know, York, of course, and I found this Reddit post where some students were discussing, you know, classes. And there was a post where a student was starting computer science at York, and they said they were interested in Japanese drama and comics. And they said that your Japanese culture, literature, and film class looked interesting because of their interest in manga and so forth. I have not attended one of your classes, so I'm not sure how you structure things. But when somebody asks me how to better learn a language, I obviously tell them immersion is the best thing possible. But outside of that, right, you can watch films, you can go to YouTube, listen to old radio programs, listen to variety shows or, you know, late night shows. So you kind of get that slang going. But could you give me a little bit of insight into how you structure the literature course material for someone interested in that?
Sure. Now, this course was a fairly large course.
Okay.
It probably averaged out over the years that I taught it at 80 or 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
There was never an empty seat.
Wow.
It filled up right away.
Okay.
So every year I had to deal with students, you know, pleading to get in. And I would tell them to come and students would drop out. And they did drop out because the reading was fairly extensive. I mean, they read, I edited a book called The Oxford Book of Japanese Short Stories.
Yes.
So I use that as my textbook, mainly because I'm laden. but also because, you know, it did cover the whole range of Japanese literature from Mori Ogai to Yoshimoto. No, wait, hold on. Yeah, Yoshimoto Banana.
And once again, if you could confirm for our audience sort of what years or
Yeah. So Mori Ozai was born in 1860, I believe, and Yoshimoto Banana was born in 1960 or thereabouts. So a century of modern Japanese literature. We had a story by Murakami Haruki, by Haruki Murakami, and that was one of the last in the book, not the last, but one of the last. It was arranged chronologically. Japanese short stories followed in the footsteps of the Oxford Book of English Short Stories, of Canadian Short Stories, and so on and so forth. It was the first one, though, that involved translations, and that made it more difficult.
Okay.
Anyway, so the students would read that book, you know, which is about 400 pages long. Okay. And then they would read novels and short stories by Kawabata. We did Snow Country a lot, by Kanizaki. We did a collection of short stories translated by Howard Hibbett that are beautiful. Mishima, we might read one of Mishima's novels. That would be in the first term. And the second term, we would move fairly quickly into contemporary.
Okay.
That would mean that we could talk about manga, anime, the things that the students were most interested in. But at the same time, you know, we would be reading. One book they liked was out by Kirino Natsuo. And that's about a group of women who have a sideline job carving up men's bodies. It's gross, but it's for some
reason. It's a story. That's a story people would want to die.
Yeah. It's the most popular novel
in
the world.
But that's a great example. I mean, do you reach for a film or a genre that you can, I don't know if the right word is link, but in order, you know, if there's a student that says, oh, this class is making me want to learn Japanese, you know, is there a way to encourage them into more film or?
Well, you know, in that course, we would look at Kurosawa, Akira Kurosawa, Yasujiro Ozu, and Kenji Mizoguchi.
Okay.
To start, right? And then you'd go from there into some of the other classic directors. And in the second term, we'd be looking at, you know, at contemporary directors, including, what's his name?
I feel like it's such a treasure to be able to talk about literature. And then if you're going through specific periods, you can tie them with cultural things that are going on. I've only guest lectured on text, but I have tried to even just take very, you know, small snippets of text from film, from screenplays, or and I will take, say, two or three sentences from a film probably that the students have never seen. I tend to reach back into the black and white or something know, you know, and I'll put it up on a screen and ask them to tell me what the story is about just by those two lines, right? So I imagine that it can do a lot for students who are also just encountering Japan.
I think so.
In some way.
You know, the film writer, film director I blanked on is Itami Juzo. So we would look at Itami Juzo's Tampopo, which is one of my favorite movies. My students love that Tampopo. And then we would read perhaps Haruki Murakami's The End of the World, The Hardboiled Wonderland and The End of the World, and talk about postmodernism and how, you know, pastiche can be used in film and how pastiche can be used in literature. And kind of understand narrative in a slightly different way, and they were pretty good at that. I mean, I'm teaching a class not of literature majors, or certainly not Japanese majors. Many of them are computer science students and economic students and so forth.
Okay.
But they, you know, actually, in many cases, they got into it. But there would be dropouts at the beginning because they didn't expect to read.
To read so much. Well, you know, I think that's a lot of college courses, right?
Yeah,
kids get to college and they're like, what is this? I didn't have to do this in high school.
Yeah. Well, I give them a quiz at the beginning of every class to make sure they'd read what they were supposed to read. You know, and then it was clear who was doing the work.
Sure, of course.
And you know, that also drove people away. But by the end, we'd have maybe 80% of the original class, and they'd all be working pretty hard.
Well, that's pretty good. I'd love to ask you about sort of the learning process right now. We have We've got a lot of kids growing up in the U.S. who are growing up multilingual, bilingual.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who want to take languages, right? They start maybe in junior high or high school and they continue onward. But with generative AI and the pace of technology, if you have never traveled to another country outside the U.S., someone might say to you, well, you don't even need to learn the language because you've got your phone, right? You just whip out your phone and look up the phrase that you need. I personally think there's a lot of value in learning languages, but this kind of assumption that we don't need to learn languages anymore. I mean, what would you say to encourage someone who's learning languages not to stop? What is it about humans that makes us kind of uniquely capable, right? To clarify the distance between cultures versus a machine, in your opinion?
Well, there are two things. One is, you know, Canada is different than the United States.
Yes.
And one of the ways that Canada is different, we have two national languages.
Okay.
So that means everybody is expected to have at least a cursory knowledge of the other language. And then the thing that's more important than that is that in Toronto, the majority of Torontonians were not born in Canada.
Mm.
So they've come from India, China, the Philippines, not so many Japanese, but we have over a million Indo-Canadians,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
roughly a million Chinese Canadians in the city of Toronto. So Toronto is about one third Asian, slightly more than that. Filipinos also are a large group.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my students speak a different language at home. So when we talk about translation,
mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about something that's unfamiliar to them. So let's say you're taking your grandmother to the hospital
mm-hmm.
because your parents are working, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're only 14, but you're old enough to take your grandmother to the hospital.
Yeah.
And the doctor asks her questions about her state of health and how she feels.
Yeah.
And she's speaking a language in which those terms are different than English terms, as it would be for Japanese Canadian.
Sure.
And so you're making those adjustments and learning in a way without consciously being aware of it, how to translate.
Mm-hmm.
So then in a class situation, when I put students together in groups and they talk about their own translation experiences to each other, you hear these little gasps or shouts of recognition.
Wow,
oh, so
amazing.
You had to do that too, or you had to deal with that problem too, you know? So this kind of sharing of language and not just language, but kind of concepts,
mm-hmm.
right? The fact that it's not just English, mm-hmm. that you're not living in a just English world.
Right.
And those types of things aren't going to be solved by, it'll help you to, obviously, to have a translation app in your cell phone so that you can communicate with someone. Mm-hmm. But that's just scratching the surface, you know, to understand what they're really talking about. You've got to get into the depths of language, and language is deep.
That's a very nice way to say it. Language is deep. I remember reading that you said you had translated poems for a friend whose grandfather was in the Japanese internment camp here in the U.S. And for our audience who may not be aware, following the attack at Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government was very suspicious.
And the Canadian government
of people of Japanese descent, whether they were foreign-born or American citizens. And President Roosevelt, in I think February 1942, issued Executive Order 9066, which resulted in the internment, or what they would call relocation, of people into these Japanese internment camps in the West. And I was taking a look at this poem by an anonymous person living in the internment camp called That Damned Fence, which a lot of people have read. And I'm reading through the last two stanzas, and if you'll just bear with me, the second to last one says, "Loyalty we know and patriotism we feel. To sacrifice our utmost was our ideal. to fight for our country and die perhaps, but we're here because we happen to be Japs. Do you have, I don't want to say rules, but translating things like derogatory slurs or what some people consider to be, you know, derogatory, is there, do you, sometimes you just a feeling that you don't even want to deal with that, or is it in a way more important to you when you're dealing with things like this, these kinds of topics where a person is in an internment camp and they're literally not free? Do you gravitate towards something like that, or would you rather be translating, you know, a novel? I imagine for your friend, obviously it was important. This is a friend of yours, and that friend couldn't read what was there. It also made me think that's highly emotional. You know, in a way, does translating something for someone close to you or for a friend, does that require more time, more attention?
So my roommate at Oberlin was a Japanese American.
Great.
From Portland.
Okay.
And he and I are still close, despite the distance between our homes.
Mm.
And, you know, generally speaking, I'm 76, so most sansei are about my age.
Okay.
Sansei means third generation. So
yes,
Uisei came from Japan. Nisei grew up in a house with often a parent who only spoke to them in Japanese. Mm-hmm. So they were bilingual in a functional way. Mm-hmm. And sansei are distant. It's their grandparents who spoke the language. Their parents' first language was English.
And when you say in a functional way, you mean just everyday living?
Yeah, yeah.
I
mean,
that
you wouldn't necessarily be literate. It's very difficult to be literate in Japanese. Mm. The Issei were literate. Japan's educational system in the 1880s and 90s was very, very good, the best in the world, actually. So the Japanese who came here had the ability to read,
mm-hmm.
Who came in here, meaning either Japan or the Canada or the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time you reach the sansei, their grandparents may not be there, or mm-hmm. they maybe never had a great communication with them for language reasons. Some of them became studied Japanese and became mm-hmm. very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a generational thing. So I was there with my friends who are Japanese, Canadian, or American in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, as I studied more, read more, you know, Joy Kogawa, who became a friend, wrote a book called Obasan, or Aunt, but it's in the original, it's Obasan, O-B-A-S-A-N.
Mm-hmm.
She became a friend, and she's older than me, and she'd been through it. So she was 10 when the internment ended.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you feel tasked to share history. I feel this in a variety of ways. You know, the Vietnam War, for example,
mm-hmm.
or the fight against racism. In this case, the internment and the racism that underlay.
So you're talking as a fellow human being, you feel the task to help.
Yeah,
in some way.
And you're standing up there teaching, so that gives you an outlet, you a microphone to teach mm-hmm. about racism in this case, why people had to suffer the way the Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians suffered.
Mm-hmm.
They had everything taken from them.
Mm-hmm.
They were cast out of their homes and pushed inland, in the case of the United States, into fenced camps,
mm-hmm.
in the case of Canada, into old mining towns in the mountains, and forced to live there for the duration of the war.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, that level of injustice is important to share mm-hmm. With young people because they don't know.
Yeah. Do you feel that many translators do, that you know, at least they do try as much as possible to involve themselves in areas like this where they might be of help? Or do you think, I mean, maybe that's just a personal decision, I guess. It's hard to say that all translators involve themselves in something historical. But
well,
I do...
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I could point to Jay Rubin. You know, Jay Rubin is a good friend,
mm-hmm.
And he's married to a Japanese native. They met even before I was in Japan. So they were, they also, like my wife and I, have a very long relationship. And the two of them became involved in Japanese-American redress and then in the history of that whole movement.
Mm-hmm.
They even wrote a novel called The Sun Gods in English about that time.
Mm-hmm.
So Jay Rubin would be, he's a brilliant translator, maybe the best translator of contemporary literature, but he's also someone who has spent a lot of time helping or not uncover, but, you know, broadcast what mm-hmm. happened in those years and what racism means if you are Japanese American.
I would also think that for a literary translator, especially, I personally believe that learning languages actually helps your mental health. But mm-hmm. as a literary translator, you may be, especially in your case, if you are translating authors who are known to come up with these stories that, you know, maybe seem so out of the ordinary, that you feel that when you are translating, you are maybe helping people discover a part of their own personality that they're not aware of, right? Because why else would you be excited reading this, you know? Do you feel that your career has actually helped your mental health in some way or helped you examine something about yourself?
Gosh, that's a difficult question. Yeah, it's a really difficult question.
I got a job.
I was already past 40, but I got a job, and I'm now having taught for 40 years. I'm living on a pension, which is pretty good.
You know?
I had a job I enjoyed, and that certainly helped my mental health. I have a family here, so I have two mm-hmm. kids and three grandkids who I'm close to. That helped my mental health. And I try to stay loose, you know, like try not to get too hung up on little things.
Yeah.
And enjoy myself.
Yeah.
So it's hard. You know, my daughter is one of my daughters. I have two.
Mm-hmm.
But she is conversant with all the different acronyms, you know, ADHD and all the others, right?
Mm.
And so she tends to categorize people according to their mental health. And I'm a wreck, according to her. According to her, you know, I've got all kinds of things wrong with me. And I don't listen to her because I don't give a damn about where I fit on the spectrum of mental health. I'm just trying to make it, you know.
I'm just trying to make it through the day. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's so interesting, right? Because I've spoken with professionals in different fields. So maybe they're translating video games, or they're subtitling films, or they're interpreting at a G7 meeting, or they're interpreting at a war crimes tribunal. In terms of being a literary translator, you're not just a translator. You also edit a translation journal, Monkey, which is a publication that highlights contemporary Japanese writing. So when I think of translators, if you're translating a purely technical document, I would think you're going on accuracy. But in literary translation, I would think that you are going for fluidity, that you are good at sort of choosing a number of ways to express what the author is saying, which I think on some level is good for your mental health because you're very good with trial and error and that sort of thing. Would you say that translators, especially literary translators, are more the obsessive type because they're trying so hard to find the perfect phrase, or do you kind of have to be loose to be in your field? Because you may be struggling with what the author is saying and you've got to come up with different ways and then kind of, you know.
Yeah. I mean, to use the Japanese phrase, it's case by case. And in this case,
yes.
I'm translating two stories right now.
Okay.
One is by Haruki Murakami,
mm-hmm.
and the other is by a writer named Edogawa Rampo,
Okay.
And Edo Baladampo is a writer from the 1920s, 1930s, and he took his name from Edgar Allan Poe. So okay. Edgar Allan Poe becomes Edo Baladampo. And he writes in a very difficult style for me.
Okay.
And the story that I'm working on involves crafting a voice for someone who's not like me at all, who is slightly crazy and who is manipulative.
Ooh.
And is...
are you talking about in a narcissistic way or...
A very disturbing man. Okay. The voice of a very disturbed man.
Okay.
And it's horror. So that leads to a horrific conclusion. That's hard. The Murakami story, I've translated a lot of Murakami over the years, and I've read almost everything that he's written. And I feel very much at home in his style.
Mm.
So I have an easy time.
Mm-hmm.
But there, the problem is rhythm.
Okay.
With Murakami, rhythm is terribly important. So you need to have, you know, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. You know, it's a kind of jazz metaphor.
And are you, but are you talking about just in his novels or even if it's a short story or an essay?
Even a short story, everything
regardless.
He writes.
Yeah.
Everything he writes. He has a natural rhythm. And how he developed that rhythm is interesting. I translated his first two novels, and the book is called Wind Pinball.
Mm-hmm.
Hyun Sing and Pinball 1973 are the names mm-hmm. of novellas. And he there's an extensive introduction to that, a preface which he wrote, which describes how he found his voice. But he has a voice. So you have to be able to find an English equivalent. In the case of Edo Baladampo, there it's also voice more than anything else, because this voice is a suffering and highly manipulative and dangerous voice. And so, you know, that how you get into that, it's a little bit like acting. You know, if you, especially a short story like this, which is a monologue from this disturbed man. But you kind of get into the character. And once you I'm not there yet, right? I'm still working on it. I've read it. I've started translating it. I don't like what I've done so far. I'm going to go back. But I'm trying to get that voice.
Well, so in this case, I mean, do you treat this differently? Do you say, you know, are you a regimented person where you say, do this for work on this for 4 hours this morning and then I'm going to take a break? Or do you read through all at once? Do you revisit and have you know, take a break and do something specific to go back to it with a fresh mind? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, Utica, that's a very good question. And I should say that I'm not alone.
Okay.
I have... behind me, Shibata Motoyuki, who looks at what I've done and helps. I have Meg Taylor, who's the other editor at Monkey.
And just for our audience, we're talking about Monkey, the publication.
We're talking
journal.
About Monkey, yes. But we're also talking about Motoyuki Shibata, because he is an extraordinary talent. And at the core, at the center of so much taking place in Japanese literature and in the intersection of American and Japanese literatures. I have a friend who will answer my first questions when I, you know, don't understand something basic, who I can ask. So they're like, let's see, how many? That's three people? Mm-hmm. Probably more behind me. So this makes my job more fun, because you're working with people as opposed to being isolated in a small room, and much, much better. You know, the quality of what I do is much, much better thanks to them. So translation, especially from Japanese to English or vice versa, I think requires at the very least a friendly ear, someone who you can talk to. And you know, the if I look at translators, probably the first requirement is not the other language. If you're an English speaker translating Japanese, the issue is not how well you know Japanese. Obviously, you have to know it pretty well, but it's how good you are in your own language, in English, because that's where the voice, that's where the rhythm comes from. So you can't say that. Yeah, you have to have that. And so I'm, you know, lucky that way. That for me, I think it's because I'm a singer. I play my guitar and I sing literally hundreds of songs. And I've been doing that since I was 11, 12 years old. I love it. And so I have all these lyrics stored in my head. So mm-hmm. to some extent, I'm drawing from those lyrics. And when I translated Wind Pinball, mm-hmm. Those early Murakami novellas, I was able to draw on that store of song lyrics a lot.
Yeah.
So again, it's...
I can see that connection because I believe songwriters and singers are passionate about text, right? They are trying to get this story across through song.
Yep.
So it's a... Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah.
So going a bit forward from there, I don't know what the situation is currently in Toronto, but here in the U.S., we see a lot of libraries experiencing budget cuts. You know, we've seen book bans, which are usually more about sort of people arguing about the content. But there are also language studies being cut more from universities, not all universities, but some. And so I kind of wonder what this does, right, to people in terms of learning languages and cultures outside of our own. Why do you think it is important for any of us to make the effort to learn a language or culture outside of our own? I know that you're in a unique situation because, you know, there's a lot of diversity in Toronto, just like here in New York. There are many parts of the U.S. where, you know, it may not be that diverse. But even in New York, right? I mean, there may be someone who just never wants to travel or just doesn't see a point in leaving. What is the importance of learning something outside of what you know?
Yeah, again, there's a difference between Canada and the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
So to start with, you know, you have the bilingual nature of Canada mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. the multilingual nature of all Canadian cities. It's not only Toronto. You look across the country, all the big cities are multilingual, multicultural. Mm. So this is where you start. You have public education systems which are doing a valiant job educating the children of these new immigrants. Mm. That is hard work. And most of the students that I taught at York spoke a different language at home.
Yeah.
So it's ongoing. We don't have an attack on education and the intelligentsia in the way that you see from a distance, see in the United States. The idea that you would undermine public education by appointing unqualified people mm-hmm. to head the Department of Education, that's shocking.
Yeah.
And revolting. I mean, what you're doing is you are undermining your new generation. But of course, the idea is that new generation is a threat to the way things used to be in the case of the United States, you know, electorate. So there's a strong attack on education. You don't see that in Canada, but you do see underfunding.
Okay.
And the underfunding, of course, comes part and parcel with the rise in the cost of living, with
sure.
the problem of finding accommodation. And you have all these competing interests looking for resources mm-hmm. and education gets cut. So we're fighting to sustain a working public education system. If you think back on Japan, think of Japan in 1880. Right. Around that time, they realized, hey, man, you know, like we're going to have to educate our people if we want to compete with those European countries. And they went whole hog.
Yes, they did.
You know, by 1890, Japan was the most literate country in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was all in the space of 10 or 15 years. So that's what you need. Right. You need public education at a high level. You need to support the teachers. It's a hard job, but that's where a country's strength comes from. And that's something that the United States may find is perhaps a contributor to the loss of power and influence. And maybe it's just a natural cycle. You know, imperial countries fall ultimately. One reason they fall is because they know less about everybody else than everybody else knows about them.
Right.
This is true for China. If we look back, everybody could talk about Chinese thinkers, read classical Chinese. You know, if you were Vietnamese or Korean or Japanese, you knew classical Chinese if you were an educated person.
Yeah.
So that you knew more about the Chinese. So the Chinese didn't really deign to understand much about anybody else because they considered themselves to be the central kingdom. No one else was important. And right. there's direct parallels between that and the United States today.
Well, I think the one other issue is that a lot of people are looking at their kids and saying, you know, you got to live, right? You got to pay your rent. You got to get a good job. You got to get a really good paying job. And then the question becomes, can you make money as a translator? You know, and it sort of gets away from that uber joy that I think you can feel when you do choose words to help something be expressed. There is just a kind of, I don't know, it's a reward that you can't replicate. I don't know any other way to really describe it. I think you've said before that you're lucky in what you do. And I agree with that. I just hope that everybody will remain open. And if language is something that intrigues you, keep going. Don't stop.
Yeah. And I know we're coming to the end. So I'll say that as a translator, things are better now than they used to be because of the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Sure.
You know, when I was down in, when I was translating Murakami and talking to people in the publishing world in New York, they kept saying, can you find, what's his name? Sven Swig Erickson or something like that, the original writer. And he wrote a series of books, you know, which have become movies and which were translated and became million sellers. And so they're out there looking for the next big hit. So if you are an aspiring translator and you can read Japanese in this case, then I would go out there and see if I can find somebody like Murakami or some of the other popular writers of today and introduce them and offer a financially rewarding arrangement to a publishing company.
Not a bad idea.
You know, you have to make you have to live, right? So not many people are going to make a living as translators. And now with AI, it's going to be even harder. So that means, but AI can't do literature.
Right.
Thank God. So you have that.
Well, I remember, you've also said, you know, for example, Kawakami Hiromi, right? Yeah. There's a musicality or the onomatopoeia or the way that she, it's all encompassing as the person reading it. And I'm sure as the person translating it, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Translating Hiromi Kawakami is so much fun. And if for those who are curious about the kind of stuff she writes, check out Dragon Palace. Dragon Palace is, I think, 7 stories. And they're about shape-changing and kind of animal slash human characters, but she has a powerful voice and she's very much interested in, I think you were there when she talked about her own marriage and her own, when she was forced to kind of recreate herself after a failed marriage. And it comes through in those stories. So they're fun. They're tremendously imaginative, but they're also deep, you know,
they reflect what the human being is going through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today. It was great to see you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Today's episode was recorded at AT1 Studio here in New York. I'm Eureka Foster. これからもどうぞよろしくお願いいたします。ありがとうございました。